I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The Republican version of health care is now making its way through Congress. What will its changes mean for those who signed up under the Affordable Care Act? Today, we'll try to answer your questions about the American Health Care Act. Will you be paying more or less? Will you be able to get help paying the premiums? Tell us what you want to know. And the Congressional Budget Office released its assessment of Trump Care yesterday. It predicts more people will be uninsured, but premiums and the national deficit will eventually both go down. What do you make of the report? We'll finish today with this week's State House Blend, Kansas. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Less than 2 weeks ago, we spoke with our ethics professors about what a government owes its citizens, and among the examples we used were education, jobs, and health care. We were flooded with calls concerned not so much with the ethical discussion, but with the health care issue itself. We received emails during and after the show wanting to talk more about it. We heard you, and today, as the American Health Care Act is working its way through Congress, we'll try to offer some answers. We're not here to debate if one is better than the other, and we know the final version of the AHCA may differ from the original put before the House on March 6, but for the sake of this conversation, we'll be using that bill as it was presented. Here to help answer your questions are Sheldon Weisgrau. He's director of the Health Reform Resource Project. That's part of the Kansas Association for the Medically Underserved. He has more than 25 years' experience in health policy, and he's worked in multiple sectors to ensure health care services in underserved communities. Sheldon, nice to have you.
Thanks, Steve. It's good to be here.
Timothy Jost is an emeritus professor at the Washington and Lee University School of Law. He's a contributing editor at Health Affairs, where he writes a monthly summary about the latest developments in the ACA, and is a frequent contributor to Health Affairs blog. He joins us by phone. And Tim, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, the Congressional Budget Office issued its findings on the proposed American Health Care Act yesterday. How did you react to what you heard? Let us know. 816-235-2888 is the number. Again, 816-235-2888. And let's begin with the news here, Tim. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, as I mentioned, reported yesterday that 24 million more Americans would be uninsured by 2026 under the House Republican health care bill than under Obamacare, including 14 million by next year. Does that number surprise you?
It's a little bit higher than I think a lot of observers expected, but it's in the ballpark. I mean, the Affordable Care Act contained a number of provisions, including the individual mandate, the employer mandate, the premium tax credits, and the health insurance reforms intended to get people covered. And the American Health Care Act, the Republicans' proposal, would repeal retroactively the individual and employer mandates and change pretty dramatically the structure of the premium tax credits. And also, and probably most to the point, phase out the Medicaid expansions and also impose caps on Medicaid payments to the states.
So all that suggests there'll be fewer people enrolled then, given what you're describing here.
Yeah, absolutely, both in Medicaid and in the private sector.
Sheldon, you surprised by these numbers?
Yeah, I'll echo what Tim just said. I think they're a little higher than what most of us who follow these issues were expecting. They seem to be a little bit higher than a lot of the other outside independent analyses that had been done.
Is that concerning to you?
Not really. I think that, you know, the CBO has been trying to learn how to model healthcare. It's very complex, obviously, and I think their numbers are as good as we have. I just wanted to add to what Tim said. In addition to the impact on coverage, there are some really important findings here about who will gain and lose coverage. And I assume we'll be talking about that on the show. But there's going to be a real shift in who will have coverage under this law based on things like age and income.
Let's talk about that just a little bit here, Sheldon. There's this term out there in the healthcare world, universal coverage. That means covering everybody, right, if you have that. Obamacare's objective was not universal coverage, if I understand correctly. What's the objective of the Republican Health Care Act then?
I think that that's a great question. Under the Affordable Care Act, it was never going to get us to universal coverage, but had all the states implemented it in full, it would have got us about two-thirds of the way there. We're not quite there because there are many states, including my own state of Kansas, that have chosen not really to participate. I think one of the difficulties with this new bill is it's really difficult to tell what the purpose of it is, other than to roll back the Affordable Care Act. So if you look at all the different advocacy organizations out there, whether they represent physicians or hospitals or patients or insurers, none of them are in favor of this law, which really makes you wonder who it's written for.
I'm just wondering, Tim, given that, who do you think it's written for?
Well, the act includes massive tax relief. It repeals almost all of the Affordable Care Act's taxes, including in particular couple hundred million dollars in taxes for people earning more than $250,000 a year. So I think the very clear gainers under this act are Americans with very high incomes who are going to get one estimate was that for the 400 highest earning families in the United States, each of them would get an average of $7 million per year in tax cuts under this bill. The other thing it does, as Sheldon pointed out, is that it reduces the premium tax credits and certainly the Medicaid coverage available to not extremely wealthy, but middle class and younger people, and it reduces it for lower income and older people, and increases the assistance for middle income and younger people, and those are people who have been experiencing high premiums under the Affordable Care Act and can use some relief. But the older and lower income people, and particularly people who are now on Medicaid in states that expanded, are going to be the ones who are hardest hit.
So, Tim, to answer the question then that Sheldon posed here, who gains, who loses, you would answer that how?
That high income taxpayers are going to get a big tax cut. Insurers, pharmaceutical companies, medical device manufacturers are going to get big tax cuts. And middle-income people in the individual market, particularly younger people, are going to get more help. And those are the people who are aided by this legislation.
You know, Sheldon, Kalin wrote us this. I don't think the GOP understands that tax credits may work for the wealthy, but people on low or limited incomes have to pay the full premium every month and only get a refund once a year. That may well be impossible for a huge number of people. So you'll have people losing their insurance for inability to pay the premiums. Does she have a point?
Well, I think that these tax credits are designed in a way that the Affordable Care Act designed them, where they're advance premium tax credits. And so people would receive them in advance, and they'd be paid actually directly to the insurance companies, which is the way it's done currently. And so people would not have to lay out the full cost of their premium and then expect it back in a refund later. That would be taken care of upfront.
Okay. If you have health insurance through the Affordable Care Act and have a question or concern about what might change for you, you can give us a call. 816-235-2888 is a number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, these plans are very different. I want to stay with this idea for a while. One has subsidies. One has tax credits. One has an individual mandate where the uninsured have to buy health coverage. The other doesn't. In the simplest possible terms, walk me down the road again, Tim. How are these two plans different?
Well, the Affordable Care Act, again, has, as you said, the individual and employer mandate, which was the way in which the ACA intended to get people covered with health insurance, to encourage people to get covered. The AHCA repeals those. In its place, in the place of the mandate, it includes a continuous coverage requirement, which the way that was supposed to work is that as long as you are continuously covered, you can sign up for health insurance at any time, well, during an open enrollment period and get covered. But if you have a gap in coverage, then you'll have to pay a penalty when you try to enroll subsequently, a 30% penalty increase in your premiums for a year.
Is that one of the main incentives to go ahead and get coverage then, Tim?
That is. That is the main incentive in the bill to get coverage. The CBO, however, said that it wasn't going to work, which is, I think, what a lot of insurers as well as health policy.
Because why?
Thought. Because it said the first year people will try to get covered, maybe a million or so, but after that people will not get covered because they want to avoid this late enrollment penalty. And the people who will not get covered are the young, healthy people who you want, who feel they don't particularly need insurance, whereas older, sicker people will eat the 30% penalty because they'll just figure health insurance is worth more. So the CBO projects that, in fact, it will have a perverse effect of making the market worse rather than better. And they also project a huge impact of the repeal of the individual mandate.
And Sheldon, just before,
losing coverage.
Before we leave this point, this 30% penalty we're talking about here, how much is that? I mean, how much might it be?
Well, it's going to vary depending on your age and the price of your premium. So younger people are going to have lower premiums. Older folks are going to pay higher premiums. If you are buying a policy where the premiums are a few thousand dollars a year, it's going to be less than if you're an older person and are subject to a policy that might cost between $10,000 or $15,000 a year. So it's going to really vary based on age. And I think that amplifies what Tim said, that I think a simple way to look at the difference here between what the Affordable Care Act does and what this law does is that the Affordable Care Act, you pay a penalty for not being insured. Under this law, you will pay a penalty for choosing to be insured.
If you haven't been insured in the past.
If you haven't been insured in the past. And that is going to defer a lot of people, and the folks who are much more likely to be willing to pay that penalty are older people or people who are sick and know they're going to need services, and that's going to drive up costs for everybody.
But yet, the projections from Republicans, at least, is that, and the CBO concurred with some of this, this notion that premiums will actually go down over time is what the CBO concluded.
Right. So what we're going to see, according to CBO, is an initial increase in premiums. Then over time, they'll go down compared to what they would have been under the current law. And the reason they go down is really exactly what we've been talking about, where we're going to have these disincentives for older, sicker people to actually enroll in insurance. And so eventually, as we weed them out, the insurance pool will be filled with more younger, healthy people, which will improve the health risk of that pool and lower premiums. But the cost of doing that is shutting the door on a lot of older, sicker people who otherwise might need insurance.
Tim, I want to get
other reason.
Yeah, go ahead.
I could add something to that. The other reason that the CBO projects it, that the premiums will go down is because the coverage is going to be much less generous. They're projecting that because of some other changes in the legislation, that insurers are going to be predominantly offering plans with higher deductibles, higher cost sharing. And in fact, the thing that people have complained the most about under the ACA, the high deductibles and high coinsurance, is going to get worse under the AHCA.
One final point before I go to some callers, and they're starting to stack up here for us. How is it possible, Tim, that this new Republican plan, the American Health Care Act, cannot require individuals to buy insurance? Because I remember how controversial this individual mandate was under Obamacare, but I always thought that you had to have it, at least that's how it was explained, to bring in enough people into the pool to provide coverage to a lot of people. So how can this new plan survive without it?
Well, I think what the CBO believes is that it can't, it can't survive without the individual mandate and cover anywhere close to the number of people covered by the ACA. They do believe, however, as Sheldon, I believe, said, that the market will stabilize because you'll have more young and healthy people, fewer old and sick people. And also one other thing, there is about $100 billion in the bill over 10 years for states to establish premium stabilization programs, and the CBO believes that's going to make a big difference as well.
Okay, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about the American Health Care Act, the new Republican plan for health care in this country. We're dissecting it with two terrific guests here this morning. Tim Jost is an emeritus professor at Washington and Lee University School of Law. Sheldon Weisgrau is director of the Health Reform Resource Project. That's part of the Kansas Association for the Medically Underserved. Our number here, 816-235-2888. Let's go to William from Spring Hill. William, good morning.
Morning.
Go ahead, William.
Say that when the ACA was passed, it was a compromise legislation. It was due, if you don't force healthy people into the insurance program, that the premiums will naturally go up if you only insure sick people. It was due to explode about 2017, 2018, because we did not force everybody into the program. That's the way insurance works. Now, America has to decide whether they want to join the rest of the first world people in the world and provide single-payer universal health care, or whether America still wants to stumble along and keep people from that. The AHCA is going to kill people. Our decision is whether we want to be progressive and move out of ACA to help people, or whether we want to be regressive and kill people by going with AHCA. That's our choice.
William, I appreciate your comments. And this notion that the country has intentionally steered away, Sheldon, from a single-payer health plan where the government would be the single payer, basically, and the purpose of that would be to drive down costs or control costs. Why can't we go in that direction, to William's point here?
Well, I think that's a political issue. That's something that we have been struggling with for the 100 years that we've been talking about trying to do health reform.
It's seen as too big of government writ large, too much government, right?
I think that it's exactly the health care policy manifestation of this argument we have all the time, and how much government should be involved or not involved in our life. I mean, the government is heavily involved in health care already through funding through the Medicare and Medicaid programs. To some of us, it wouldn't be such a huge step to expand that to other people, but for others, that's a step too far. So,
is William right that other countries, I'm thinking of Europe, do they have mostly single payer plans over there?
There's a lot of different ways that other countries in the world do this. So I think there's a little bit of mythology on both sides of the aisle about how this is done. They're not all government run single payer programs. Some of them are. Many countries do it through private insurance, similar to the ACA. What they do have that we don't have is they do have mechanisms where everybody's enrolled. They're not worried about your income or where you live. You're born, you're in. You die, you're out. The insurance companies in those countries that do it through private insurance companies tend to be much more heavily regulated than the insurance companies here, with government maybe more involved in helping them set prices. Even if they don't specifically set prices. And so there is usually more government involvement, but it's not always through a single-payer system.
Tim, should I assume that a single-payer system automatically results in healthcare costs being driven down? You always hear that the U.S. Per capita healthcare spending so high compared to other countries. Would a single-payer plan change that, or do we know for sure?
Well, a single-payer system would make it easier to control costs, because you have everyone being paid out of a single budget. You have likely are going to have price controls. And in the United States, the reason for the high costs is not that we use more care than other countries. We don't. We use less in some ways, but rather because we pay much higher prices. So a single-payer system would permit the government to address that. Uwe Reinhardt, who's a very famous health economist at Princeton
said, yeah,
that the American government is too corrupt for a single-payer system, by which he means that we do have essentially a single-payer system with Medicare, but and it has been somewhat more effective in controlling costs than the private system, but still, because of our campaign finance laws and other ways in which our government is run, healthcare providers have been quite effective in making sure that they get as much money as possible out of the system. And I think that could very well happen with a single-payer system as well.
Okay. Let me grab some more calls here. Steve from South Kansas City. Steve, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about healthcare coverage in America. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Great topic. I'm just Joe Sixpack out here and listed all these topics on healthcare. I just come from a real-world experience. My premium back in 2015, it was $576 for my wife, myself, and two kids. And January 1 of 2016, I'm paying just under $1,500. And my deductible went from $2,500 to $6,300 per individual.
Wow.
And it's just crippling us. And I just... You know, politics aside, my fear is, how is this ever going to go down? When's the last time your electric bill went down? We had all this solar, we have all this wind. It's not going down. I'm fearful that the insurance company has a taste of these premiums, and you're not going to see them go in reverse. So I think that $14 million that you're hearing that's going to be leaving the Obamacare program, if I have the ability to leave, I'm gone. I've just got to find an inexpensive catastrophic plan. I'm willing to pay for all my other stuff out of pocket, but this is just absolutely nuts.
Sheldon, you want to respond to Steve?
Yeah, I think, you know, Steve's making a point that I think Tim made earlier on. There are a group of people who are paying a lot to buy plans on the ACA marketplace because they are of an income level that is probably too high to get substantial tax credits to help them pay. And those people are bearing the full brunt of health insurance costs. And
why would Steve's premiums have tripled from 2015 to 2016? What was happening there?
Well, what we saw in the marketplace was, and what's interesting is when you hear criticisms of the Congressional Budget Office's estimates on the Affordable Care Act, what they estimated insurance costs would be in 2017, they were actually right on the money. But what happened was we saw very, very low increases in the first couple of years of the ACA marketplace. And then in the last year, insurance companies saw that they weren't getting enough money to cover the risk that they were undertaking. And so they in most states, really jacked up the premiums in this past year to make up for that. I think what we're seeing is insurance companies are responding to A, the cost of health care, and B, the people in their pools that they're covering.
That's interesting. Let me grab one more call before a break here. Let's go to Carl from Overland Park. Carl, you're on Up to Date. Our number here, 816-235-2888. Go ahead, Carl.
Good morning. I was wondering with this new plan if there would still be a marketplace or you would buy your insurance directly. And then the second question would be, could you still maintain your own plan? Like I have a catastrophic policy. Could I still maintain that plan and still have the tax benefits and so forth?
Tim, how's this going to work? Help Carl out here.
Well, there are different provisions for the short range in the next couple of years and then beyond that. But as far as I can tell, the marketplaces would continue and they would continue to be a way in which people could buy coverage, but people would also be able to buy coverage from agents and brokers directly from insurers. There would be other options opened up as well. In terms of whether you could keep your plan if you like your plan, There isn't anything in the Act that would require insurers to stop offering whatever coverage you have now, but they might very well decide to do that. And one important factor there is that or at least they might change the premiums pretty dramatically. The new law would change the age rating ratios that are currently there. And so older people could end up paying a lot more, younger people less, and that might very well have an effect on your premiums, if not on your coverage.
Carl, does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Time for a break. When we come back here, we'll continue our good conversation about the Affordable Care Act, the American Health Care Act, how they're different, and what it means for you. Again, our number, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to UpToDate on 89.3 KCUR. Well, this hour we're talking about the ACA and the AHCA, healthcare in America, what President Trump and the Republicans are trying to do here compared to what President Obama and the Democrats had in place the last few years. Sheldon Weisgrau is with me. He's director of Health Reform Resource Project. That's part of the Kansas Association for the Medically Underserved. Tim Joyce is also here. He's an emeritus professor at the Washington and Lee University School of Law. Your questions welcome at 816-235-2888. I'm wondering, Tim, what were the main Republican objections to President Obama's Affordable Care Act? And in hindsight, in your view, was Obamacare fatally flawed? Was it eventually going to die?
Well, I think the main objections were that it was too regulatory. There was a lot of objection to the individual mandate, that it was too expensive, that it attempted to cover too many people with government funding and programs. As to whether it was fatally flawed, I don't think so. I mean, I think that we've reached the point in 2017 where there were some adjustments that needed to be made, but I do believe that there were and still are adjustments that could be made that could preserve it going forward. But the problem is that it's been there for almost 7 years now, and those adjustments haven't been made, and they're always necessary in big programs like this.
And those adjustments weren't made, Sheldon, because what, politically, once politicians took a dive in back into the act, who knows what might have happened to it. So everyone was reticent to try to fix it.
Well, I think, yeah, I'm always reluctant to dive into the motivation behind politics. But I think, explained it very simply, you had one side of the aisle that refused to do anything to this law that might help it work better. And you had another side of the aisle that, exactly as you said, was afraid to dive into it for fear of where that might lead. And as a result, we essentially got stalemate for the last 7 years, which, as Tim said, is unprecedented. No laws of this size ever go through a 7-year time period without being tinkered with and changed. And we just didn't get a chance to do that.
Donna from Shawnee called us to ask this, Tim. Will we still be able to get free health screenings through Medicare under the new law?
There are no changes under the new law to the Medicare program, except that it removes about $300 billion in funding from Medicare over 10 years, because a big part of the taxes that are being repealed were Medicare taxes. And so that might then, as a follow-on, lead to changes in the Medicare program, but this particular statute does not change the Medicare program at all.
Okay. Let's go to Janet from Shawnee. Janet, you're on UpToDate. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Janet. Yeah.
I was wondering, under the Obamacare, there was no limit. The insurance could not put like a cap on how much they paid out to you, for instance, if you got cancer. And that was really special and wonderful. And I'm wondering if this new act is going to include that same thing.
Tim, is there a cap under, as proposed in the American Health Care Act, the new act that Republicans are pushing?
As of this point, there is not. Because of the way in which the kind of legislative procedure they're using works, they really can't make substantive changes in the law that don't have financial consequences. And so a lot of things in the law that probably some Republicans would like to change, including, for example, the benefit package, cannot be changed, and the removal of annual and lifetime limits is one of those things, and there is no change in that under this legislation.
I hope that helped, Janet.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Yep, thank you. Let's go to Mansoor from Overland Park. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question about the number of uninsured that is being thrown around. I'm curious to know, what is the percentage of uninsured today in relation to the population under Obamacare versus the 24 million number that they thrown out at in 2020? And I have a second question is, would the business penalties go away under the Republican Party as well, plan as well?
Let's do this. Sheldon, take the first question about the uninsured today versus the uninsured in the years to come,
okay,
based on the change in plans here, if the new Republican plan goes through.
So before the Affordable Care Act, we had an uninsurance rate in this country of about 16%. That has dropped now to under 9% across the country, with a lot of variation from state to state, largely depending on whether that state has expanded its Medicaid program. We're looking at the CBO projection of over 10 years, another 24 million uninsured people, which would bring us 10 years from now to a total of about 52 million uninsured, which is actually more than were uninsured before the Affordable Care Act. I haven't done the math on what the percentage would be, but I assume it's going to be back up to 15 or 16%.
And Mansoor also had a question, Tim, about will employers be mandated to offer insurance? Did I get that question correctly, Mansoor?
Yes, because as an employer right now, we have to pay a penalty if you don't offer affordable and credible insurance to our employees.
Okay. Tim, what about that one?
Yeah, and that's kind of an odd part of the act, again, because of the procedures through which they're trying to get it through Congress. The penalty would be repealed. The law itself would not be repealed. And in particular, the reporting requirements are not repealed. And I've always thought that the biggest problem for employers under the employer mandate was not having to provide insurance, since most of them do, but rather having, you know, all the paperwork. And as far as,
yes,
I can tell, all of that stays in place.
If I can share a real-life story, that is absolutely correct. The amount of paperwork we have to provide to keep track of each employee almost is the same cost as offering the insurance to the employees. It's kind of ridiculous.
Hmm. Okay. Mansoor, thank you.
If I could also say that the CBO projects that one of the biggest places where there's going to be loss of coverage is going to be in employer plans, but not because the mandate goes away, but rather because the individual mandate goes away and employees will be less motivated to get it, and also because the higher subsidies for higher income people in the individual market are going to make it attractive for employers, small employers, to drop coverage and let their middle-income employees get coverage through the individual market.
You know, Sheldon, just to clarify also a couple points here, when Donald Trump and President Obama met when Barack Obama was still president, if I recall correctly, Donald Trump made a promise eventually that he would keep two features of the Affordable Care Act, and one of them had to do with pre-existing conditions, and one had to do with parents who have 20-something still on their personal health care coverage plans. Are both those promises being maintained going forward here under the Republican proposal?
Yeah, both those provisions are still in place, but they're going to play out a little differently based on the other provisions in the law. So the other promises about everybody being covered and nobody losing coverage and nobody being harmed financially are going to be hard to keep.
Okay. Let's go to Carol from Lawrence. Carol, you're on the show.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Thank you for the program.
Sure.
I believe the health of our fellow citizens is our most precious resource. And I was wondering if your speakers could talk to the listeners about the amount of profit that's taken by the for-profit health insurance companies. Thank you.
Okay. Interesting question. Tim, what about that? How much profit are the insurance companies making going forward under the Republican plan, maybe compared to what they were seeing under Obamacare?
Well, one of the things that the Affordable Care Act did was to require insurers to pay out a certain percentage of their premiums in claims or to pay rebates to their consumers so that their profits were capped in a sense. And that provision remains in place. In fact, however, over the last year or two, insurers have actually been losing money in the individual market. They're still doing well in the employer market and the Medicare and Medicaid market.
But they actually lost money, Tim, you're saying.
Yeah, many of them did. And so I'm sure they will be more profitable under this statute because, again, older and sicker people will be less likely to be insured. Younger and healthier people will be more likely to be covered. But their profits will still be capped by the medical loss rule, and I'm not sure how quickly they will become profitable again and how profitable they will be.
Okay. Well, I want to thank our guests for coming in today. This has been such a good conversation, and both of you were so good at providing, direct, straightforward answers here. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. Sheldon Weisgrau, Director of Health Reform Resource Project. That's part of the Kansas Association for the Medically Underserved. Sheldon, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Steve. It was a pleasure.
And Tim Jost, who's an emeritus professor at the Washington and Lee University School of Law out in Virginia. Tim, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
And now it's time for State House Blend Kansas, KCUR's podcast about the people and issues in the Kansas legislature. This week, hosts Sam Zeff and KCUR's Jim McLean talk with Senate President Susan Weigel.
We have to cover the budget today, taxes, and some Medicaid expansion. But with Jim's kind permission, I'm going to go ahead and take the first question and ask for your reaction this week about the possibility that Governor Brownback may be headed off to Rome with the rank of ambassador. What do you think that means for this session in Kansas going forward?
Well, certainly we're talking about it, but I think both the House and the Senate, we feel a great burden that we need to move forward no matter what happens on the second floor and fix this budget deficit.
So what is the actual sticking point now? Is it the balance between raising additional revenue through tax increases? And I know that you and a couple of others would like to see more spending cuts in that arrangement. Is that where the disconnect is at the moment, the balance between tax increases and spending cuts?
I see us, Jim, as making some very great progress. But, Jim, you've been involved in the legislature for many, many years. You know how when we start out a session in the Kansas Senate, I have 40 different opinions about how to close that gap, but we have not coalesced yet around a solution.
Okay.
You've coalesced, though. We had the Majority Leader, Jim Denning. We were fortunate to have him last week. He seems to think that everybody's come to agree that there's a $450 million figure. The question now is how you get there. So you agree with that?
Absolutely. And Jim is very good at financing. He's very bright on that. And as he stated last week, the House, the Senate, and the governor all agree that that is our deficit.
Senator Denning also said last week that looking at fiscal 2018, that he may be asking public school districts to dip in up to 2% of their reserves to help what he's calling a bridge year to get us into a really structurally balanced budget. Where are you on asking school districts to dip into their reserves at any amount?
Well, we started that conversation with schools in January when we came in. We knew we were out of balance. And Senator McGinn, our chair of the Budget Committee, and I, and a number of legislators have been talking to their school districts, and we've said, hey, are you willing to take that cut now so that we can write a new school finance formula and so that we can give you back the money and bring stability to your financial environment? The schools feel just as insecure as our agencies do right now. We all know that 18 is going to be a very tough year. The question is, and we had a lot of school districts say, yes, I will take that cut. I will use my reserves. Susan, I need stability and predictability as soon as you can get it to me. So there are a number of schools that want to participate in that. That's the direction the Senate was going, and then the Gannon decision came down last week. So,
well, then let's just go with that and ask, how does that complicate your life?
I was here for Montoy. Okay. And I don't...
That was a school finance lawsuit in previous 04. To Gannon. Right.
Yes. And the court was very specific in Montoy. And I sense a very different tune, even though we have a lot of the same people in the Gannon decision, in that, you know, Kansas is experiencing an agricultural recession, a huge downturn in receipts, an unexpected downturn, and the court has said that we're not whole till you give us another $20 million. And their employees, they've had to change their work schedules, their dockets. It's taking a long time to arrive at their dockets. Even the court is short of money. And so I feel like in this decision, they didn't tell us that a specific amount of money is what they need to make the system whole. And in fact, the decision said that 75% of your students are meeting those standards. They're doing well. What the court is concerned about is that group of at-risk students. How do we meet their needs? I felt like the tone in this decision was totally different than Montoy, because they're short of, I think they are experiencing the shortfall just like the rest of state government-funded agencies are feeling the shortfall.
But you don't really believe that you can meet constitutional muster by not putting any new money into schools to solve this adequacy problem.
No.
What you're saying is that you don't think it may not be $800 million,
it may not
be $500
million.
What this
court is requiring is that we look at how to take care of that very specific population. I'm a former school teacher. I taught emotionally disturbed kids. They were at risk. They did not say all students are underfunded. They said this group of kids are not meeting the Rose standards.
It sounds like you're talking about an awful lot of things that some people would consider somewhat tangential to a school finance formula. And I think Senator Denning also made the point that we're not going to go back to the old weighting mechanisms. So it sounds like you're talking about some very, very different kinds of approaches to solving this specific problem that the court has pointed out.
Absolutely. We have a great model for at-risk kids in the Head Start program, which is a federal program, and interventions with very young children to get them ready for school. And then the program called Follow Through that takes that specific group of kids that is also Head Start. The at-risk kids are the group that are failing, and those are the kids we want to lift up in our society and the families that we want to work with. And it does take a lot more intervention in the home life.
Well, let's just go with this for a second. I need to ask, so what's your solution to that? It sounds to me like it's not so much a school funding formula, but it is going to take more time and more money to help to reach out to these kids, whether that's in a school funding formula or you put more money into other programs to help people with parenting skills or food or healthcare, whatever that is. So you will say yes or no, this is going to take more money. Whether that goes into a school funding formula or gets spread out through other departments, you have to say that it's going to take more money.
It does.
We just don't know how much.
To intervene with that population. So the first thing I did was I called my staff and I said, I want to see if we're making use of all the federal funding we can pull down for this special group of kids. So we're researching that right now. Because even the federal government recognizes that states need assistance with this population. So we're looking to see what if we've made adequate use of the federal programs. And I believe, as I stated earlier, the court, it was a reasonable judgment, and I think it was a reasonable thing to say, help us, let's get these kids to start to succeed. But I think the court, with their experience with our finances, they know we're going to have to grow into this solution. You know, we did a tax plan on the floor. The House overrode it. And there was a lot of concern in the Senate about that tax plan being retroactive to January of this year and everybody getting a big bump in their checks right now. And a lot of people live paycheck to paycheck. I do not believe we can pass a retroactive tax. I think we're going to have to grow our – we need a structural balance. We have to grow. And we have to put that structure in place for those at-risk kids, but we're going to have to grow into financing it because you just I can't backdate a tax. It's just not right to do that to Kansans.
Jim?
The House has now passed a Medicaid expansion bill by a fairly overwhelming vote, I think. Mm-hmm. You have hearings coming up in the Senate Public Health and Welfare Committee, and everybody I talk to expects that bill to shoot out of committee and arrive on the floor. And again, the folks who support expansion think that they have the votes on the floor to pass it. Now, the bill that's being debated as we speak in D.C., the replacement bill for the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, seems to expand the window for states to expand Medicaid to January of 2020. What is your prediction, and what difference does that now make? Because, you know, again, opponents have been arguing that we need certainty, the situation at the federal level is so cloudy we can't move forward. Is that argument now gone?
Well, the bill not only expands access to the program till 2020, it also withdraws the federal support in 2020. So if we were to choose to expand...
Yeah, but that population that gets covered in the meantime gets that 90% going forward, but just that population.
Right, but it puts us in a situation that we have to pay then for the expansion in 2020. If that bill passes.
So you think what's happening at the federal level actually hurts the chances of the expansion bill here in the state?
No, I think I think that passes. I believe the bill passes on the Senate floor. I'm not sure if it's veto-proof, but it'll be close to veto-proof if it's not, because the healthcare community has become very vocal, and they want assistance. I just think the timing's wrong.
We're going to leave it there. Senator Susan Wagle from Wichita, this is where we turn State House Blend over to you, and you will pick our walk-off music.
Okay, well, I'm back in the Capitol, and we're trying to solve problems, and I like Jackson Brown's song that says, Running on Empty.
State House Blend is produced by Matt Hodan. I'm Sam Zeff, and I'll see you around the radio.
Tomorrow on the show, how forensic science is returning undocumented immigrants' remains to their families, and we'll introduce you to the new chairman of the Kansas Democratic Party. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tadakoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.